Don Lindo, Reel 5.
Mind-boggling, the amount of people, thousands of people. We tried to get out at Chancery Avenue, but we couldn't. So we went and got out at Piccadilly. I've never really seen so many people in my life. All cheering, shouting, singing, waving. We went and had a look at around Piccadilly and struggled along there to see how he was going. Everybody's rattling. The Americans were having a high old time throwing crackers out of their Rainbow Corner club windows. And we finally decided it might be prudent to have a meal before we really got going, so we pushed our way into the one of the Nuffield clubs and stuffed ourselves. And then we went into a pub and bought a bottle of whiskey and a few hats and things, and off we went to the Buckingham Palace. It really was, I don't think I'll ever forget. Everybody was cheering and not a sign of any bad temper. Everybody was laughing and climbing lampposts. The police were joining in. And we spent quite a long time round the Buckingham Palace yelling for the King, and which he came out, and Winston Churchill and the Queen and Princess Elizabeth and Princess Margaret. And then we wandered back around a bit and came back again. And it really was quite something, and everybody singing Land of Hope and Glory and God Save the King and stuff.
Did you have flags?
Oh, we had flags, we had rattles, we waved hats, you've no idea how one managed to get these things. I think we probably found them, but eventually when it sort of started to drizzle about sort of 10 o'clock, so we thought perhaps we'd better wend our way home. How we got home, I'm really not quite sure. But I had a terrible headache the next morning, and my uniform was covered with red paint, but still, we didn't seem to have done anything too awful. But it really was quite something, and it was well worth celebrating. Shortly after this, things got back to normal, and I was given a new boss, who was an Australian wing commander, who was an accident investigation officer for the group. Which meant that the aircraft, when an aircraft crashed, he had to go first to the point of takeoff, then to the crash, and then to the aircraft's destination. It was quite a job, as often we were away for several days visiting various camps all over the place, depending on where the crash had taken place. And quite often, if we weren't near an air base, we had to stay in funny little inns and stations and hotels and things, but it was very interesting. It was also a sad job, really, because a lot of the crashes had been seemed to be unnecessary. I mean, the whole of the war had finished, and quite a lot of the wartime pilots had become instructors, and they were sort of killed teaching new pilots, having got through the war without being shot at, which was really sad.
Did you get to know what some of the causes were?
Unfortunately, quite a lot of the causes were carelessness, I think. One never knows. I mean, a lot of them were instructors teaching youngsters, and presumably they can make mistakes. But, I mean, a lot of our work was done up in the Welsh mountains when aeroplanes just disappeared, and used to spend ages looking for them, and you used to have a Welsh farmers and coming and telling you that there was a plane over there, and then another one telling you it was somewhere else. It took us quite a long time. We were quite often away for days on end. But they all had different stories as to what had happened. But we had one quite nasty experience. Was we were looking for an aeroplane up in one of the things, and we suddenly got a message. Somebody came rushing out of, I can't remember, I think it was out of an office or a shop or something, with a, saying that they were trying to get hold of us because there'd been a crash about 10 miles away, so we sort of whizzed off there. And it was really rather horrible because the plane was still burning and one of the pilots was still inside. It was really very nasty.
Would you say that was one of the worst experiences?
Well, it was just horrible that it was sort of, you couldn't do anything about it. I mean, he was already dead, poor chap, but it seemed so unnecessary to lose your life, you know, when you've probably been through the war, fighting Germans all the time. And some of them were amazing. Another one had crashed up in the tree in the Breckens and was lying on its back one wing was 200 yards away, and all that happened, the pilot broke his wrist, so that you just can't tell, you know. It just was sad that they thought of them had gone through so much and it ended up unnecessarily, really.
Although it was sad work, it must have been very interesting gathering evidence.
Well, it was sort of... you got so many different versions of the same thing, and you know, and some said it was came down at 6 o'clock, others said it came down at 10 o'clock, others said it was on fire, others said it weren't. You're never quite sure, but he was very patient, and we eventually sort of wheedled it out, and then we had to go to where it was going to go to see whether they'd had any messages as to what had happened. And it took quite a long time, but it was intensely interesting, actually.
Around this time, did you have any opportunities for, you know, lighter moments, say, for playing sport?
Yes, well, I did actually play quite a lot of sport, and I played quite a lot of hockey and badminton, because most Air Force stations have big hangars, and they're very good for playing badminton in. And, of course, they have sort of fields. We played a lot of hockey. I used to play a lot of mixed hockey, which was apparently very dangerous. The men said we were always much more dangerous than they were. But it was good fun, actually. And then that sort of, about the sort of, I suppose, end of the 1945, having been away for about 4.5 years, a rumour went round that all, it was a ministry order, actually, saying that all people who had come from who were living outside the empire could have 61 days leave after 4 years' service. So I thought, well, I come from a place which is not in the empire, so I filled in all sorts of forms and stuff, because I found out that my demob wasn't going to be anywhere until in the new year. And I filled in all these forms, and off I sent them, but I applied for a Portuguese visa and got that all in order, and then finally the Air Ministry decided I couldn't go because of the transport difficulties, but that was, I suppose, inevitable, really. So I lost interest in that and gave up until I was demobbed. Then I did it, and then I applied. I thought, I'll apply to go to the Azores, because the Americans were using the Azores as a great big base, and I speak Portuguese, just the job. But no, they didn't want drivers. So I said, well, look, I can go something else, can't I? So that fell through. So obviously, they determined I wasn't going to go anywhere except out, I think.
Did you get to talk to the Australian wing commander very much?
Oh yes, we had lots of chats, because I mean, we drove about 15,000 miles together, I think, on and off. And when we were sort of travelling around, if we stayed the night in an Air Force station, of course, I stayed with the in the WAF section, and he stayed with the officers. But quite often we had to stay in small hotels and things. So it was very nice. We used to play, I don't know what it's called, piquet or something, I think, in the evenings, or play darts with the locals. But he was very interesting.
Did he tell you about life in Australia?
Not a lot, no. He was quite tight about that. I think he lived out in sort of Queensland somewhere, I think. But he wasn't very forthcoming, and I wasn't going to probe, really.
Can you recall his name?
Yes, his name was Larkin. But I can't remember his surname or his Christian name. I don't think I ever knew one. I must have done, I suppose, but I don't know. But eventually he was here for him to be, time for him to be demobbed, and I think he was going to go back to Australia. So he said he would like to take me out to dinner, which I thought was great. So when I hadn't got anything to wear, so I rushed down to Virginia Water to see what I could find. Found myself borrowed all sorts of bits and pieces. And he took me out to a restaurant in London. We had a lovely evening, actually. And I never heard from him again, so I hope he's got back safely. But he was very nice. We had a lot of fun. We had a very nice relationship of sort of not really driver and officer, you know, just sort of nice friendly relationship. And soon after that, I think we... Well, there's one thing I must just say before we go on, was that quite early in my career, at one of the meetings of the Porto people, we all decided we should wear little shoulder flashes, as like the Australians did and the New Zealanders and the Poles did. But this, of course, was strictly against rules because Portugal was neutral, but we decided perhaps we could get away with it. So there was a little shop in Charing Cross Road which made these things. So about five of us trooped in there one day and asked them to make Portugal shoulder lashes. I think I took mine off about five times before I finally put it on my battle dress, which wasn't seen on parade, so that was all right. But they looked rather nice. I mean, there's no reason why we shouldn't wear them. We've been serving for quite a long time. But it just sort of made one feel a bit different. It actually brought back quite a lot, because a good few years later, my husband was an architect. And he worked for Lloyd's Bank as a chief staff architect, and soon after the war ended, the Lloyd's Bank started rebuilding all the banks that had been bombed over the years, and one of them was in Bristol. So I went down with him, I think it was in early 1950, I think, and while he was doing his work, I said, well, I'm going to go up down to where I used to live and see what's happening up there, if it's gone back to its owners or what. So if I went up to the Downs and looked at all the houses we'd stayed in, who I think had probably gone back to their owners or somebody, they were all being lived in. And just up the road was a little petrol station where we used to fill up all the RAF vehicles. And I thought, well, I'll fill up, put some petrol in. And when I sort of got there, the chap came wandering out. It was the days when somebody filled it up for you. He said, oh, I know you. So I looked at him and I said, yes, I know you too. And he said, I remember you're the lady who used to wear Portugal on your shoulder. So we had a long chat. And he said, life's not so exciting these days. But it's nice to sort of remember old things, you know.
Would you like to describe what it was like tying up the loose ends?
Well, it's getting demobbed, you mean?
Mm.
Well, it's quite a job. My demob thing came through... I knew I was going to be demobbed in March, and I wanted to get back to Portugal before the end of March, because a great friend of mine was being married and hadn't seen for long. And then it transpired that if you didn't take all your leave before you got demobbed, you didn't get it. So I thought, well, I must take mine. So on January the 16th, I departed on 19 days leave, which I've never had so much leave in my life, I don't think. And I spent days with friends in Norfolk and Nora in Taunton. Yeah, it went quite quickly, actually, in relations. And then when I returned from my leave, I had my medical, which was a sign at least I was going to be demobbed soonish. I must be getting to the top of the pile, I think. So I decided what I really must do is to try and fix up a flight back to Portugal, because planes were then flying from Northolt to Lisbon. When there weren't very many, so you had to, it was British Overseas Airways in those days. And I rang them up. And they said, well, they could give me a flight on March the 18th. But I had no idea whether I was going to be demobbed by then, but I thought, well, I'll book it anyway. So I booked it, and then I cabled my father for the money, which he produced. And then one day, quite out of the blue, a signal came that I should report to Demob Centre at Withall, which is in Birmingham, on March the 11th. So I got this message on March the 4th and decided, right, that was the end of that, I'm not going to work anymore. So I went down to Virginia Water and got all my stuff ready together, because you had to take back all your Air Force stuff. And on the 11th, off I went to Withall to be demobbed.
Can you recall what you were allowed to keep?
Yes, we could keep the uniform and a cap, a pair of stockings and a shirt and shoes. And you could keep the greatcoat, or they would buy it off you back for £2 or something. So, and I managed to... The thing was to go to the equipment store and try and get new things which you could then keep. And I managed to get a new battle dress, which was quite useful, because they were very useful to wear those.
The men received a suit, didn't they?
Oh, yes, they had a suit and a hat. And, but we I suppose they couldn't give women clothes, because they wouldn't all wear the same stuff, would they? So But no, I don't know what happened to my uniform. I suppose I took it back with me because I had very little. I mean, you couldn't take very much luggage with you because I flew back on the 18th of March with a suitcase. I was pretty much overweight, but I had a good sob story that I'd been away from home for nearly 6 years and all the rest of it. So they were very good. They let me through. But it seemed quite funny going back to Northolt as a passenger, having been so many times as a chauffeur, you know. And I was a bit apprehensive. I didn't know how I was going to get on with my family after, you know, you leave at 18 and you go back as 23 or 4 streetwise. It's a bit difficult. But
did you, when you did go back, did you continue living with your parents?
Well, I went back, yes, and they met me in Lisbon. Then we had to drive up to Porto. And it was really funny going back. A lot of us, I mean, they'd been about, I suppose, 20 or 30 people roughly my age who joined up, and we were all drifting back as we got demobbed. And we all were completely different, you know. We'd sort of been away from home, we'd lived our own lives, and I don't quite know what our parents imagined. I mean, one girl I know, I mean, when she got home, she'd been in the Wrens. And her father asked if she'd like a little sherry or something, and she said, good grief, no, I'm going to have a double whiskey, please. You know, we'd all grown up, you know, it's a big difference. And if you looked after yourself for 5.5 years, you do grow up, you know, particularly in those circumstances.
Did you feel, though, that you'd lost a lot of your youth?
I think I'd lost a lot of the early part. I mean, I would quite like to have done things like try and be a vet or things like that, but by the time you come out, it's too late. I think it was the beginning part, but I wouldn't have missed it for anything. I thought it was a wonderful experience. What I did miss, actually, was the camaraderie. I got terribly bored out there, you know, because you'd all been all right, you were ordered about, but you knew exactly what you had to do when you had friends. But there was sort of nobody out there could talk to you, unless there were your friends who'd been in the forces, could talk to you about what you've been doing. And, you know, parents were interested up to a point, but they didn't understand, really. You know, it was quite difficult. Because I only stayed out there for about, 6 months, and I came back to England. I nearly joined up again, and I went and joined the BBC instead. But I think I should have joined again, really.
What did you do with the BBC?
I worked in the Portuguese section for nearly a year. But I think I should have joined again. I would have enjoyed it. I don't think I wouldn't have been a driver. I might have been an officer. But I think it would have been fun to have a short service commission or something, you know. But still, it was all good fun. But I certainly would not have missed it. It was great.
I suppose the important thing was that you did what you want to do, too.
Yes, I think so. And, I mean, I'd hated to have... It must have been very difficult for civilians, I think. Particularly people with small children. Because only although children had extra food and stuff, it wasn't very much, you know, and you had to make things out of nothing almost, and the clothing was difficult. It must have been very difficult being a civilian. We were very spoiled, really, because we always had food and we always had transport, really, and, you know.
But that was vital because you had to be just so on top because, you know, you were doing such important work.
Yes, you had to up to a point, but it wasn't difficult physically. Like, I mean, it wasn't, no, not mentally, perhaps it was more difficult for civilians, I think, because they had difficulties with their lives, whereas everything was provided for, I think. This is the thing. I mean, if you tore your coat, you went into the stores and got a new one, you know. I mean, whereas they had to patch it up and no coupons.
Like you say, you felt you were part of a big family.
Oh, yes, I think you did. But it was very strange going home, really, really strange. I don't think my parents ever quite understood, you know. Difficult a bit, but still, it's a long time ago now.
So, what sentiments are you left with after that?
I think that the sentiments, I mean, everybody had to do something. I mean, the sentiments, I think, is that A, I made some good friends, but unfortunately, what happened was that whereas a lot of ex-service people kept up with each other, as I went straight back to Portugal, I lost touch with a tremendous lot of people. I kept up with Nora, but I lost touch because I disappeared for 6 months, you see, whereas they probably met, and you know, yes, I missed, I just did miss a lot of that. But no, I just don't know. I think it made you grow up, and it certainly made me much more tolerant, I think. Because, I mean, going from being slightly sort of spoiled and child to living with all sorts of people, it does make a ton. And, I mean, I just like talking to people now. I don't mind what colour they are, where they come from, you know, whereas probably before one might have been a bit, what they say, snooty, perhaps.
So you were living with discipline, weren't you?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But you had to, I mean, quite a lot of the officers and the sergeants were most strange, but I mean, you just got on, they were higher up than you, you did as you were told, you know. And discipline doesn't do anybody any harm, I don't think. And there's a lack of discipline nowadays, I fear, you know. But what I think is sad also is that my son is quite interested in what mother did during the war. My daughter hasn't the vaguest interest at all.
What age is she?
Well, she's now 53. But she never has had much. You know, when they used to have, at one point on the television, they used to have a thing called All Our Yesterdays, which was newsreels from the war. She couldn't imagine that they were actually happening. She thought there was a film, like Gladiators or anything. Whereas it was actual things happening, you know, bombings of things. She just couldn't imagine it.
And does she have children?
She's got a son who's in the Navy. But she's strange, but he is quite interested in all the... I mean, he's 3 years younger than her, but he's interested in all the machinery and the what you did and what you wore and where you went and that sort of stuff.
Very often the grandchildren become interested.
Yes, well, they might see my grandson, my daughter's son, is in the Navy. I mean, at the moment there's nothing much, but he's been sort of around Croatia and all around there on his ships and stuff. But yes, I think the youngsters seem to be quite... interested now, you know. I mean, grandsons and good thing too, I think, really, you know.
Do you keep in contact with any people that you serve with?
Well, not really now. I mean, well, there's one in America I do who's lives in Idaho. She was in the equipment. And I've got this friend down in Selsey who I didn't serve with, but we've sort of palled up since, called, I can't remember her name. Drummond Hay. Now, she was in the WAF, and she was a Stirling, which I've remembered now, the aeroplane. And she always moved with her planes. The whole camp moved. But she would be good on your program, because she was a different sort of Air Force. I mean, she just was bombers all the time, you know.
Maybe you'd like to see if she would.
Well, yes, well, I've got her. I can give her a ring when I get home. I go home on Friday, so then... But she's got, and they have quite a sort of sterling sort of club, I suppose, really, you know. But tell your husband it's sterling, I've now remembered.
for a number of years.
Well, now, perhaps it might be interesting to see what stations I've served in. At Bridge North, Pacheli, Innsworth in Gloucester, Hemswell in Lincolnshire, Balloon Headquarters at Bristol, Balloon Command Stanmore, and 11 Fighter Group at Uxbridge. And the total mileage I drove during the war was 52,305 miles. And the vehicles I drove were Hillman Minx cars and vans, Ford V8 staff car, Buick staff car, Fordson 3-ton lorry, Chevrolet 30 hundred weight lorry, Morris ambulance, Albion fire engine, a Dodge 3-ton coach, the standard 500 weight and 10 hundred weight vans, a Comma 30 hundred weight lorry, and a Hotchkiss crane. So there you go.
You've had a book published. Would you like to mention the name? Its title?
Yeah. All this news was gleaned from the book I wrote quite a long time ago now, called A WAF at War, Wartime Jottings of a WAF Driver. I guess given that the title of the book I wrote, well, it was first written in 1991, and since then it's had two different editions, so that each one is slightly different, but the context is exactly the same, it's just the cover's different, I think.